I think everything in general, but only being able to throw 2+ innings. Before today, probably wasn't that terrible, but today is not good. I don't know. Just moving forward from this one and just getting some work and make the adjustment. Focusing and the good things and just trying to come back and feel like myself and, you know, forget about the past and just moving forward and trying to become, you know, like who really I am and take it that way and just finish in that way to the season. I think I've been a little inconsistent, but I have time to be better.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Monday, June the 22nd, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join me at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Happy Monday, everybody here. Hope everybody's doing well. Coming to you after the Mets lost 2-3 in Philadelphia, late Sunday night baseball game. And we do our thing here. We keep plugging away, but little bit what we're going to talk about today, we're going to get into Freddy Peralta. I think I have looked at Freddy Peralta's numbers, and there may be something more going on than just bad performance, so I'll play a little junior pitching coach, a little junior doctor over here. A lot of talk over here on our chat room on social media about Carlos Mendoza. The Mets are playing the Phillies. Phillies made a managerial change early in the year, worked for them. Why didn't the Mets? What's going on with Mendoza? Why are they sticking with Mendoza? Will it matter? And of course, we got a little bit of mailbag, so we'll get to that as we round out the show. So, every time it seems like we get a glimmer of hope with this Mets team, you know, players coming back from injuries, Lindor's on the doorstep of coming back, Mets playing better. They've played, you know, about 520, 530 baseball since the May 1st. Much better, not what you expected when they made the free agent signings over the offseason, not where you wanted them to be, but they've been better since the horrible April and really since the 12-game losing streak, although they've dropped off a little bit here in June. And I think the thing that has a lot of Mets fans, and rightfully so, starting to talk about selling or when they hit the deadline, some kind of combo of selling and retooling for 2027 is that, you know, everybody evokes OMG summer, and that's reasonable because the Mets at some points earlier in June have had the same record as that Mets team. But what a lot of people forget, everybody talks about the playoff run. Everybody remembers how they played 650 baseball. They won a ton of games down the stretch to get into the postseason and barely get into the postseason, mind you. But that team, after that horrible month of May, after the Jorge Lopez glove-throwing incident, and they were 9-19 in May, very similar type of poor month to what you saw this past April. Throughout the summer, June and July, they played well over 650 baseball. And even in August, when they had a road trip and struggled a little bit, they were 15-13, and they played 536 baseball. So they played really good baseball over a 90-day span, and played baseball well over the 100-win rate for that period of time, and then in September brought it home. This team has yet to play anywhere near that type of baseball, and maybe at times they play baseball like the OMG Mets played in August when they were going through the dog days of August and a road trip and all those things. But until you see them go on a run, and seriously, and we've seen people comment about this on social media and here even at the Talking Mets podcast chat, getting to 500 is that first marker. You really can't take anything that they do seriously. And after this week, on the road, playing teams that are in front of them, playing one team that is right there at the top of the wild card heap out of this muck. And right now it's a muck, but the experience with the wild card is that muck in May and June and July, and maybe even into early August, weeds itself out very quickly. Eventually it'll thin out. Eventually teams will probably start to play at a mid to high 80s rate normally. And the teams that are 5, 6, 7, 8 games under 500 or at or just below 500 will start to see those games back of the last wild card spot become a little bit more onerous. And that's what the history of the wild card has been. Now, so far this season, a lot of parity. But baseball is such a long, long marathon. We're not even at the end of June yet. We're not even at, or we're getting close, but we're not even at the midpoint yet. We're getting right there where you're close to that 81 game mark, but you're not there yet. So as a result, we at the end of the getting to know you phase pointed out what this team needs, and it's very clear that starting pitching, especially starting pitching that can give them innings, is one of those things, and getting some of the bats back. I don't think they're going to get Polanco back anytime soon. It seems like this lower body injury, which is a death knell for a player, even a DH, has really ruined his season. Whether it will ruin both years of his contract is a whole other story altogether. So they need that extra bat, and they probably need some kind of complement at first base to Jared Young, a halfway decent component left-handed bat. We'll see as he gets more exposed what that's all about. All those things are not going to matter if the Mets are out of the wild card race, because the whole focus will be what assets do they have that they can bring in some talent at the deadline, whether it be Luke Weaver. I know we're going to get into Peralta in a minute, and that seems unlikely with the way he's pitching and some of the warning signs that are there, and so on and so forth. Since Memorial Day, since we had that, for us anyway, that symbolic end of the first phase of the season, I've never felt that this team was really in it. I think over the last couple of weeks, as we've tried to say, okay, what does this team need to really get themselves in a good place? I've never felt they were completely out of it. I think they've been hovering around that tease. But after this week, I think it's, and especially because a couple of the games were complete no-shows. The Senga start in Cincinnati, obviously what happened on national TV, which bothered a lot of fans on Saturday night, with Peralta giving up 10 runs in a little over 2 innings in Philadelphia. Nobody wants to see that in front of a national audience. A lot of the good vibes from the Yankee series, a lot of the good vibes from some better play, albeit against lesser competition in late May, maybe even into early June, has dissipated. And nobody is a better symbol of this disappointment, I think, of 2026 than Freddy Peralta. Going into this morning, going into his next start, which will be later this week, Peralta is a below league average pitcher. It would be his worst performance since he was brought up mainly as reliever in 2019. As you go through many of his seasons, now this was a guy that I think had a career year last year. Everybody was going gaga. I was happy with the deal. At the end of the day, it was a risk well taken. The Mets did not give up an A.J. Ewing. The Mets did not give up an Elian Pena. The Mets did not give up a Carson Benj. I think the players that right now in the system are some of your jewels. They did give up Brandon Sproat, who may or may not turn out to be a decent pitcher. And they gave up a decent prospect in Jet Williams, who has been okay, but nothing special at the AAA level. Now, did they give up another Pete Carmstrong? Did they give up, Jared Kelnick? Even though I know what Jared Kelnick turned into. No, I don't think so. I don't think so. You never know. So it was a risk well taken for a player that could have anchored the rotation. Maybe ace is a loose term. We talked about not so fast. Don't sign him. I mean, I've been on record since the deal happened. This is a good deal. But let's not go crazy about signing him. He's good, But he's not an ace. He's not Zach Wheeler that's going to go deep. He's not that guy. But he is going into the season better than maybe what you had with Luis Severino, although he hasn't played like that a couple of years ago. He's better than Manaea. He's certainly better than Senga. And he was a veteran pitcher who finished in the top five in the Cy Young that could anchor the rotation that you thought would have Nolan McLean, possibly Jonah Tong, at some point Christian Scott, obviously Clay Holmes, a veteran. And it made a ton of sense. Now, nobody could have predicted a pitcher that had a career year, mind you, but nobody could have predicted what you saw here. Sub-500 pitcher, ERA just a shade under 5, below league average, hit per inning. And it starts to make you wonder, well, what's wrong? Is it a curse where players come to the Mets and underperform? Is it some free agent year jitters? I mean, we've talked about that a lot with every free agent. I mean, we've seen when Soto came here. We talked about when Beltran came here. We don't talk a lot about pitchers, but Tom Glavine had his struggles early in his free agent contract. That had a lot to do with Quest Tech and how they were calling balls and strikes, and he had to make some adjustments. Mike Hampton, although he had the NLCS MVP, he struggled early on when he was in a Mets uniform. It took him a while to get adjusted. Not quite here as long as Freddy Peralta, but his first couple of months were rough when he was in a Mets uniform. So is that what's going on with Peralta? Well, I'm not so sure. And I'll tell you why I'm not so sure. Because one of the things, and I was going through the Savant page, and I am not a data analyst expert. I don't work in a front office. I'm not a pitching coach. I didn't play at a high level. So let me just put it out there. That's not who I am. But I am here to say, okay, let's get the brain moving. Let's start to think. And as I'm going through all, and sometimes these savant pages could be overwhelming. We take pride in back of the paper bag math. But here, with this savant page, I mean, you get deep into the weeds of horizontal breaks and vertical breaks and heat maps and all sorts of stuff that it'll blow your mind. So I'm not sitting here saying that I looked at all that and I could break it down like a front office data analyst expert. And there are probably plenty of websites and individuals far more adept to get deep in the weeds with the math on this. But let's just take a common sense approach. And when the one thing that stood out to me, and it's one that you usually don't look at, but it jumped out at me at the page. If you scroll down below the fold, is year by year, Freddy Peralta's arm angle. And it is noticeable that this year, 2026, he has a significantly lower arm angle than any other season, even at his lowest point in 2022. And that's significant because I'll tell you why in a minute. Normally, since they started tracking this on Savant in 2020, he's been between 36 and 37 degrees, 38 last year in his Cy Young season. And this year he's at 32. Now, does that immediately mean there's an issue? Well, no. That could be something purposely done because they want to maybe work on his pitch movement. Maybe they want some more movement on his four-seamer. Maybe they want to tweak the sweeper. And things like that. I mean, I don't have a breakdown of what his arm angle would be. They're giving you an overall one on these numbers. I mean, these are publicly available numbers. So it's not like, okay, I just found something that they don't know about. I'm sure they know about it. But when you go to the stats, you can't help but notice that his four-seam fastball is getting hit much harder this year. He's not getting clobbered, but it's a significant uptick from last year. And when you start to look at subsequent years before that, let's not even go to the Cy Young season, or the near, I shouldn't say the Cy Young season, the career year season. You start to look at, 24 and things like that. I mean, what you see is that his fastball this year, and well, I mean, what better game than the game on Saturday night, is extremely hittable. Maybe not too much higher but significantly higher than what we saw in 2025. And then you look at the strikeout rate. Right now, if the season ended, Freddy Peralta is at a career low 8.7 per nine inning strikeout rate, lower than 2022. 2022 was his last season like that. Again, this is significant. And I started to wonder, well, when you see a pitcher's arm angle change, well, that's usually something that indicates perhaps some kind of fatigue or injury. And if you go back to Freddy Peralta's injury history, he has had an injury history of lats and shoulder inflammation and things. And a lot of that was in 2022. So if you go to 2022, the same year where he had the injury, where his arm angle dropped prior to this year, the most of his career, he only made 17 starts. And he had a teres major strain. He had shoulder inflammation, fatigue, was out more than 2 months. You've got to start to wonder if that's at play here. And I think that's a really fair comment. And I wouldn't be surprised. And I know I even mentioned this. I just threw this out on social media on Sunday afternoon before the game. And people are like, oh, making excuses. He's the Phantom IL. No. And do the Mets know something about it? I mean, if I'm looking at this, they clearly know. Now, if it's a situation where Willard and the pitching analytics department said, hey, we got to lower your arm angle because you got to be more effective with your sweeper, or some sort of situation with his pitch mix, it ain't working. I could tell you that. And definitely some of the command issues that he's talked about, or even heard Carlos Mendoza talk about, are part of that drop. You're going to see a declining whiff rate. You're going to see more contact. You're going to see reduced velocity. By the way, you want to throw another piece into the mix. His fastball is down 1 mile per hour. His curveball is down about 3 or 4 miles per hour. All this could be part of a pitching plan for some way or another. I mean, his walk rate is relatively the same that it's always been. It's maybe a tick higher, but 3.6 is not that much different than a year ago. And we've all seen he's had games where he's walked a batter an inning in some starts. That's why you had the five-inning Freddy stuff. So this complicates things because he's not pitching well. He's a free agent at the end of the year. You would think, because he was a top pitcher last year, and he was a pitcher that was on the market, it was in demand, and maybe Tarek Skubal will be on the market. He's going to be the cream of the trade deadline crop. But the hope was that, hey, maybe the Mets could get something. And now, with the way he's pitching, it might make more sense to give him the qualifying offer at the end of the year and see if he takes it. Now, we don't know what the rules are going to be going into a lockout. So it might not matter. That qualifying offer may not matter. And with the lockout, who knows? They may just, we don't know what free agency is going to look like. So this is all sorts of bad. Now, I think because of the lockout, because of the uncertainty, the best case scenario is to trade him. But if you're going to get nothing for him or just salary relief for the last 2 months or some, iffy prospect, think about the kind of, it's very real that with where he's at, with the kind of injury that he has, potentially, I'm just speculating, going back to the shoulder lat that we saw in 2022, all the signs are, the smoke is around it, that you might not get any better package than what you saw out of Scherzer and Verlander. And this is a guy that, in his prime, was expecting a Max Fried-type contract of 7 or 8 years, was expected to go out and be a staff leader on a playoff team. And we're talking about, well, maybe they could get something in a similar package to what they got in the Scherzer-Verlander situation, which right now isn't that much. I mean, Acuna turned into Luis Robert Jr. And right now, if Ryan Clifford doesn't work out, you basically got Verlander for a couple of months of Tyler Rogers. Very helpful if you made it to the postseason and went deep, but not a lot. Now, those guys were at the end of their Cy Young Hall of Fame careers and very expensive. Well, and Verlander had some money owed to him. So that, Scherzer had some money owed to him. So that's a whole different story. I think they both did. I'd have to go back. It doesn't matter. You get the point. So this is probably, in terms of disappointments on the entire season, this is probably right up there. Team is disappointing. Peralta's been disappointing. And now the cherry on top is that his performance or potential that what I see is something of a harbinger of an injury puts the cherry on top of bed. Now, he could have a great stretch into the All-Star break, coming out of the All-Star break. Nothing would be better than he goes out and he pitches and swings the pendulum the other way and pitches dominantly for the month of July. And then the Mets tease, similar to how the 2023 Mets teased, and they kind of hover into that, despite being under 500, hover into that wild card race. And remember, there's been teams, you know, one of the teams I always bring up when there's a couple of teams in the history of baseball that played similarly to the Mets, scattered in a one wild card scenario. I always think of the 95 Yankees, who didn't get going till late and really burst and made the postseason with a big September. And they were under 500 going into like late July at that point before they made the David Cohn trade. And the 96, the Orioles as well. I'm trying to think. I think it was the 96 Orioles at times were kind of like up and down and maybe even under 500 at certain points. And they kind of, I think they were like 50 and 55 or something like that. I think it was the 96 Orioles. Look it up. So there's been some history of that. It's not the path you want to take. The path of the OMG Mets is not the path you want to take. But right now, let's be honest and be fair, after this week, after two contenders really had no trouble taking two out of three from the Mets, and they needed some late-inning heroics in the opener in Philadelphia to nail down the opener and not get swept. You know, you look at this, and you got to start to think about, hey, this ain't going to be anywhere near a season where September is going to matter. But we'll see. So some things to think about. That's some of my analysis on Freddie Peralta. Outside of telling you, hey, he stinks, or he's got New York jitters, or he's got free agent walk year jitters, whatever the nonsense you're going to hear on talk radio, I tried to dive a little deep and look under the hood. This is what I saw. We'll see what comes of it. All right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, a lot of fans have wanted Carlos Mendoza fired. I keep hearing the word, Cohen needs to show accountability. Somebody needs to lose their job because of what's going on. You know when someone's going to lose their job? Mendoza's probably not going to come back after the season. That's the accountability. You could wait. Instant gratification sometimes is not something that makes sense in the course of a baseball season. So let's take a quick break. Let's get into Carlos Mendoza right after this.
Third time in less than a week, you had a starting pitcher kind of get jumped right out of the gate like that. How do you come back from something like that?
We have no choice. We got to find a way, right? I mean, it's on us to continue to figure this thing out. You know, trying to help these guys because there's no other way to look around it. You know, like those are the guys that you know we're counting on, and you know we need to help them.
All right, we're back. So, the other piece of this disappointing Mets season is, and by the way, I hope everybody had a great Father's Day. I didn't wish everybody a good Father's Day in the opener, maybe because it was the day after, but hope everybody had a good Father's Day and enjoyed themselves on what finally a beautiful weather weekend in New York. It's been iffy throughout the spring, the weather on the days that everybody's off and whatnot. But one of the things that I think as we head into past Father's Day here and into the meat of the summer, now that the Knicks have been put aside after a week of celebrating and we're still well over a month away or about a month away from NFL training camps, baseball's the star of the show. The Mets can't hide anymore. I mean, unless you want to say they're going to hide behind the World Cup, maybe for some of you, they're not going to hide. They're there. They're front and center. And the focus of the media and those who do all sports in this town, they're going to shift. They've been all focused on the Knicks. Now they're going to focus on the Mets. And I think one of the topics, which has been a topic pretty much since the end of last year when they didn't make the playoffs. And for most of this year with the struggles is Carlos Mendoza and the manager. And I've talked about managers pretty much since the inception of this show. I never was a big Terry Collins fan. And I've been hoping for one of two things throughout the existence of this program. One, that the Mets find themselves a young manager that could be the skipper in the mold of what you saw Davey Johnson take over and be part of a successful run, or in a lot of ways what you saw with the Twins with Ron Gardenhire, where he came in and he was, you know, Tom Kelly, guys like that, and stays with the organization a long time. Now, I know in Minnesota that's different, and being able to do that in a Minnesota is hard. I think about how the Pirates brought Jimmy Leland in as a young manager, and he had so much success and was with them a while. I mean, that's kind of the vision of, well, let's let the Mets do that. Across town, the Yankees had Torrey, and then they had the run with Girardi. And let's, the most comparable type of situation is what Aaron Boone came in at the broadcast booth and what he has done. And unlike Mendoza, who had a very successful first season, Boone has had his ups and downs, but Boone's ups and downs were in the context of the floor being a wild card or a playoff appearance, not in not making the playoffs, and this year potentially being a second division club. And that was always the goal. Now, the other piece was, as the team was more of a need to be relevant win now, is to bring in a experienced manager. Joe Girardi was a name, myself included, everybody thought about after Mickey Callaway was fired 2019, and he wound up going to the Phillies, and the Mets went a different direction there with Beltran, and we all know what happened there. So I don't know how many of those guys are around. I know Alex Cora's name comes up, and you know, basically that's going to be an off-season conversation. And I think that's part of, and rightfully so, if you go to our chat, Tim wrote, if you're going to talk about Mendoza, you know, talk about the dynamic of bringing in a manager with experience versus a new manager. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I think the reason why a lot of people, a lot of fans are upset with Mendoza, it's not just the team struggles. And I think at this point, his post games are very, very much what a baseball manager who's trying to get his club going. We have the players. We know you could do it. I'm supporting you. And, you know, we got to get it done. And fans are getting tired of that. And I know that there's been some people pointing out that in post-game shows, you know, nobody's really talking about the leadership on the club. And I think a lot of this is being amplified, too. And I hate to keep bringing up the Knicks because they've been in the news. And I know that there's probably even, and I know there's some baseball fans because I've gotten the feedback. They're like, hey, stop talking about the Knicks on your show. But I think the fan reaction on this is amplified because they see how, and I'll be honest, myself included, you know, it was in the NBA and basketball, and there's ills in that league. You know, everybody knows that. We could go on a whole different tangent with that. But the conversation is around players and coaches, head coaches. Because a front office could be involved all they want. They could be involved in building the team. They could be involved in putting in their guy. They could be involved in a philosophy. But while that game's going on in the NBA, you can't be a push-button guy. You have to be able to ebb and flow and assess the situation. And no script. I mean, you could maybe script out certain scenarios, but it's impossible to script out an NBA game completely. Baseball, it's a little bit different. So you see the people on the court, whereas in baseball, it's increasingly Ryan Cashman, David Stearns. I mean, David Stearns gets talked about more from this fan base and this town than anybody else in a Mets uniform, more than Soto, more than Lindor, more than Peralta. And that's probably part of the problem with baseball, where the front office has taken control because it's become a little bit of Stratomatic baseball. I mean, when I'm growing up in the 80s, it was about Davey Johnson in the dugout. It was about Strawberry. It was about Bobby Valentine. It was about Piazza. It was about, Leiter. It wasn't about Steve Phillips all the time. You know, when you talk about Steve Phillips, off-season, maybe with some free agency, when he got himself in trouble and got himself on a leave of absence, with Frank Cashin, you very rarely heard from Frank Cashin. Frank Cashin didn't do, well, nor did Steve Phillips, press conference at the beginning of every homestand. And if he didn't do it, David doesn't do it, Stearns, well, he's hiding. I mean, I think the front office has become too much of a thing. And Stearns is one guy. There is a front office. I mean, it's not Stearns in a room with 12 young people in front of computers running numbers. I mean, there's assistant general managers. I've brought this up. I brought this up on other shows I've been on. But to stay on point here, I think the Mets look at a manager, and I've said this a billion times, so I'll say it a billion and one or a billion and two. You know, you look at a manager of how they run the clubhouse, how they manage up to the front office and work with the front office, manage the media. That's their other stakeholder. And I think the biggest, and this could be scripted, but you have to also have some critical knowledge as the ebbs and flows of a game come. He has to manage a bullpen. And I don't think Mendoza does a great job of it all the time. He's certainly not the worst I've seen over the last 20 years. Really is not. And by the way, the bullpen's actually been one of the bigger strengths of the Mets. And I think one of the things about managing a bullpen is not just lefty-righty or seeing who is the right fit that, you know, you bring in Luke Weaver, not when the team is down two runs and you don't think you come back, but you want to use the right pitcher to keep the team in the game and use Luke Weaver the next day when you're up by a run in the eighth inning. You know, there's part of that. You know, it's making sure that you don't get these guys up too often or burn them out. And that was a big problem with Terry Collins. It's not just strategy. It's managing workload and workload that we don't see in terms of them just warming up and being ready and everything. I mean, I don't think he's been great. I don't think he's been horrible. But the things that the front office wants, which is leadership, communication, running a clean clubhouse. I mean, he still has tons of credibility. I know 2024 seems so long ago, but it's really not. It's two summers ago. I mean, we're less than 2 years since that postseason run, but I know that a lot has happened since then. And I think that Stearns looks at Mendoza as, hey, if the team is prepared, if the team is, the clubhouse is being managed, all the strategy and the tactics, we could bridge that gap. We're not really hiring him for that. He's not all that awful in that. He's not doing anything egregious. So I'm going to keep him around. Now, whether or not he has done enough to earn an extension is another thing. And I don't know, because this is where the pressure from the media, the pressure from the fans, the pressure from Cohen, where it's going to be hard if this team doesn't make some kind of run late. It's going to be hard to see him come back. But at the end of the day, I don't see a modern front office going outside the box and bringing in anybody that is, you know, that old school type of manager. That and the Phillies are a perfect example, and I think this is what a lot of the Mets fans are pointing to, that hey, the Phillies were playing terrible baseball in April. They had a 10-16 April. And they've played 650-plus baseball since Mattingly took over. Now, I would argue that the pendulum swung for them. And this was going to happen anyway with Rob Thompson as the manager. I could also argue that Wheeler and Sanchez, and we saw them firsthand up front and center this weekend, anchoring the top of that rotation, gives you great chances to win their starts. I mean, Sanchez had an Oral Hershiser type of run. So is that Mattingly or is that right place, right time? It's the same thing I said about Buddy Harrelson in 1990. I think the Mets would have turned it around under Davey. I mean, Frank Cashman wanted to make a change. Him and Davey weren't getting along. The Mets got off to a bad start the first 45, 50 games. Gave him a chance to make a change that he wanted to make. He wanted to move on from Davey. It was a couple of years in the making. Buddy comes in, Mets have a big summer. They flail down the stretch against Pittsburgh. And, you know, Buddy is still lauded. Hey, the Mets had a good season. They fell short. We'll come back next year. Buddy was a bad manager. Buddy did not like the job or the things that entailed, all the things that entailed the job, the media part of it. You know, Buddy was a baseball guy. He wanted, as a coach, he could teach and interact with the players. As a manager, that's not your role anymore. You're as much of a manage up, manage down, manage sideways. And, you know, he didn't like that. He told me that himself, may God rest his soul, when I sat with him many, many years ago for a Long Island Ducks game. So, you know, that's part of the equation. So it goes back to Mendoza. I don't think firing him will change anything. I mean, putting Kai Correa, putting Andy Green in the dugout. I don't think there's a big name manager out there that's ready to take, you know, the mantle right now. I really don't. And I think the question is, what will the Mets do this offseason? And this might be the first conversation, because I have a feeling it's going to be a rough. This is a rough summer for us here at the podcast. I think early offseason, with some of the lockout talk, I think we'll still be able to talk about a manager. We'll still be able to talk about the beginnings of the structure of the 27 team. But I think then we're going to get short-circuited probably right after Thanksgiving. I think the last time they locked it out was around December 1st. And then I think you're going to have a long period of labor, probably into the spring. And I think that's going to dampen things. And I got to tell you, that's a dangerous thing for Steve Cohen. And I'll get to it in the mailbag. Because I think this fan base is disenchanted, apathetic, angry. And then you take the product away. And the one thing that in the winter months that the product provides you, which is transaction log and hope, and you take that away and you have this fan base stew and simmer on 26. And let's say Mendoza comes back, Mendoza, or a managerial hire they're not happy with. And that's a recipe for disaster. Look, if I had my druthers after all that's been through and knowing that Cohen is in a similar situation that the Wilpons face quite a bit, which is a credibility issue with the team on the field and a credibility issue where he's now hired, he inherited Rojas, he hired Buck and allowed Stearns to fire Buck. Now Mendoza would be his second manager. He'd be on his fourth manager, the inherited one, the two that were under his watch, and now the next one. You got to kind of be right. And if the answer is, well, I'll bring Andy Green out of the front office or Kai Correa or another first-timer, that better be the next Davey Johnson. And I understand everybody's like caught up in Knicks fever and they see how the coach is up there singing Who Let the Dogs Out and the impact he had, you know, conversing with the players on changing the in-game strategy during the playoffs. And you say to yourself, that would never happen in baseball. Everything has to come down from the front office. And it's just not going to change in baseball. Baseball has gone through... He's gone way outside the curve here, way outside the window of old school manager field control. I don't know when it's going to swing back. The best name out there would be bringing in Alex Cora, someone who has spit and vinegar, somebody that I think would be able to handle the New York media. I think he's a guy that would be more problematic managing up, and I don't know what the Mets feel. Cole may turn to Stern and say, look, I want this guy. And if Mattingly and the Phillies continue to play 650 baseball, his son being the GM, and with Donnie Baseball being this, at least in baseball circles, a beloved figure, a guy that many would love to see make the Hall of Fame, I got to tell you, I mean, they're 33-16 under him. Why would they get rid of him? Now, is he the right manager long term? I mean, I'm not going to get into Mattingly's pros and cons. He's been around a while. Dodgers, you know, had some success with the Dodgers. Also, got some criticism when he was with the Dodgers. So Alex Cora is there. Now, Alex Cora has a contract, so he could sit home and get paid and wait and spend some time with his family. Does he really want to get back on the sauce next year? Can the Mets make it worth his while when he loses that contract? Money shouldn't be a problem. I guess we'll see. But unless there's a big issue with Mendoza, and I see what people are saying about the Spider-Man mask and the team celebrating. Guys, this is a baseball issue. I hate the dugout celebrations. Should you have more awareness when you're down 11-0 not to take a mask and go in the dugout and celebrate? Yeah. Is that veteran leadership? Probably. But everybody does it. Next time the Mets are up 10-0 or 8-1, see what the other team does. That's a league, that's a generational thing. I thought it was absurd. I think the spider mask is absurd. I think all the dugout celebrations. I thought the OMG thing was kind of fun. I think it connected with the fans on a larger note. The construction hat or the Spider-Man mask or whatever these teams come up with every year. They had the horse. I hated the horse when Alonso was jumping around on the horse. And the dugout. Like, I just hate it all. Like, you could have, like, hand things and get a little goofy at home plate and the scrum and the pile, like, and look, I just talked about the NBA. I mean, look, how many times after a three-pointer, even in games that there's blowouts, you see Mikal Bridges doing the three or Brunson with his thing. I mean, but even, I think Brunson has some self-awareness. When the team is getting blown out, I don't think he's doing all that. I think he's doing that in big moments. I don't know. Maybe I should pay more attention to that. But anyway, I think the answer to all this is you got to ride this season out. You're not going to see Mendoza take the fall because you're angry. Because in Stearns' world, he's executing the blueprint. The clubhouse is clean. The accountability piece or what you want to talk about. Now, the big criticism, preparedness with the way that they handle the automatic strike zone, I think that's a conversation a lot of teams have to have because there has to be a certain amount of awareness of it's like challenges in the NBA. You know, there might be a unless it's blatant and you know you could win that challenge in the first quarter, 2 minutes in on an out-of-bounds play, you better not challenge. That's why the bench manages the NBA, because players will be swinging their finger to challenge all the time. Now, in baseball, the catcher, the hitter, the pitcher, they all have control. The dugout doesn't have the control. Personally, I have been so impressed with ABS, you might as well just go to it and figure out a way where the umpire could get automatic balls and strikes. Maybe they call it, and if it's wrong, they get alerted somehow from above. Take it out of the player's hands. Because it's so good, it's so clean, and let's be fair, when you're 0.1 inches off or 0.2 inches off one way or the other, north, south, east, west, I even find a hard time, I believe it's hard for the players to actually know. They're kind of crapshooting it at that point. When you're an inch below, I mean, that could be an emotional, a player gets emotional, they tap their helmet, it could happen. I mean, is that a culture thing or is that a manager thing? Well, that's where it comes into play, where maybe the manager says, hey, this is our strategy. Maybe you could blame Mendoza for that. But again, when the front office controls everything, when the front office is dictating everything, at some point, you don't know, or when you think all that, you don't know what this guy can and can't do. And the players know that. I mean, you think all these lineups are coming out of Mendoza? I don't think so. I don't think Mendoza's saying, you know, I feel something. My gut's telling me I need to put this guy in. All these things we talked about with Bobby Valentine and how Bobby was able to really have a feel for his teams and get component players like Benny Agbayani, Jay Payton, Matt Franco, guys like that into the lineup. Desi Relaford. I could go on and on of different component players that had success. Todd Pratt in a Mets uniform during that era. I don't know. I don't think that's happening right now. So anyway, let's take a quick break, wrap up mailbag, and we'll talk more. We'll hear from you right after this. All right, we're back. Let's hear from the fans here. And leading off is Steve. And Steve tells me, to be honest, the season has been a significant drag. I've been a fan for almost 30 seasons. And this is the most disconnected I've ever felt. Part of it might be my focus on the Knicks run, but it's primarily the disappointment of another season not living up to expectations. A team that scores a lot, but gives up runs is far more entertaining than a team that simply can't score. There is nothing more boring than a struggling offense. While this isn't the worst team we've had, watching them has generally started to feel like a chore. I find myself sitting there and accepting what's happening without any emotional reaction. I'm bored and apathetic. Often just leaving the games on as background noise. Even in past down seasons, I would follow every pitch like a playoff game. I hate that. I hate that I feel this way. I felt similarly in 2017, but in the seasons of 18 and 20, but in the seasons of 18 to 20 and 2023, I at least felt excitement over the search for new GMs. Now I don't even know what to look forward to. I really want to look forward to the games and feel the highs and lows again, but right now it's just not there. On a final note, I think the owners are a joke by wanting to eliminate 8 rounds of the draft to suggest they are prioritizing their pockets of what is best for the game, and it's a reminder of why we shouldn't simply take their side in these negotiations. They care about their pockets, that's all. So, a lot there with Steve, and this is a dangerous email, and I'll tell you why. This is the worst type of email that Steve Cohen can have, because this is a fan. He's a fan. He's a little younger than me based on what it is. He's a fan for 30 seasons. So he started to watch the Mets probably as maybe he was 10 or 11 years old in 1996 or 1997. And so he's a little bit younger than me, but he's finally been beaten down. This is a guy that probably is not going to spend his hard-earned money to go to the ballpark this summer. Unless he just wants to have a night out, maybe it's a team in town, maybe it's a nice weekend, maybe there's a giveaway, maybe he just wants to go have a night out with his friends or his significant other or whatever. But that's where it's dangerous. When you have a guy that lives and dies in bad seasons with every pitch and now is having a hard time even putting the game on, feels obligated because it's his passion. He doesn't want to miss out. He also doesn't want to seem like a fair weather. That's a problem. Now, I think he's right. I think, Steve, you're right. I think the Knicks have created this. I think the excitement and the drama and all the things that you want out of a New York sports season, team, run, connection, the Knicks provided that. Now, be fair, and Steve, you'll agree with this, there were times in January where you weren't so keen on the Knicks and putting the Knicks on were a chore when they're losing by 40 to Dallas at home and they're losing 9 out of 11 in the middle of a snowy January and the Mets are signing free agents in your middle of that, you probably were not so keen on the Knicks. But I get it. That's the ebbs and flows of any season. You're going to have, even when you win a championship, even when you make the playoffs and make a deep run or just have a good season, you're going to have those valleys. So I think this is the problem. And I think the only way to energize a fan base after a season like this is possibly with a manager. Like if the Mets brought in Alex Cora, I think that changes the dynamic. I mean, how many other big name managers out there? You're not going to go back to Tony La Russa or the Joe Girardi route. They're past their prime. And I don't even think La Russa wants to manage. Who knows what Girardi wants? I mean, you bring in a former Met just because they're a former Met. Does Beltran excite people? I mean, David Wright doesn't want to manage. Piazza, from what I understand, doesn't want to manage. You can't just bring in a name. This is not the independent league where you're bringing in a name to draw fans to the ballpark. You need someone who wants to do the job. Now, as far as, and I'm not going to get too deep into his other piece of his email, where he talks about the whole owners and eliminating drafts and minor leagues and stuff. I'm going to get deeper into that another time. Here's my analysis. I don't think you should take sides on any of the collective bargaining. I think you should really look for, as a fan, the best situation for the sport going forward. And there are pros and cons on both sides. And so far, I thought the players' offers were better than what I've heard at the ownership group. I do think we're at a point where would it be better for players to develop at the college level than getting paid spit money in bumble you-know-what minor league town, low A? And would there be a way to incorporate college baseball into the fabric of the communities more so than it is now, similar to what college basketball is? Probably, forget about college football. Probably difficult. I think the biggest thing about eliminating minor leagues and talent out of the minor leagues, and even eliminating, because what they really want to do is eliminate the filler. And I was listening to Ernie Dove. I mean, the Mets with injuries right now are having trouble filling rosters out there. You have to sign players just to fill out rosters sometimes. And with pitchers not going long, I mean, you're bringing a lot of people into the organization that never are going to get a big league shot. The problem is that when I was a kid going to Rochester, going to Pawtucket, going to a minor league town, you know, when I've covered Binghamton and Scranton, and I mean, I could go on and on and on. When you go to these minor league, these small towns, there were generally fans that would show up and be into these teams. They weren't into seeing the latest Mets prospect get promoted. I remember going to Binghamton after Daniel Murphy had been called up in 2008, and some of the fans were seeing the Mets score pop up on the scoreboard, and they were angry that the Mets were winning because, oh, you stole Murphy from us, because they wanted Murphy to be part of the stretch drive there. And, you know, that's just crazy. But so I think that that's a bigger thing when it comes to, you know, the whole collective bargaining and what's been going on with them trying to eliminate the draft and chip away more at the minor leagues. Sean writes, discipline. Hey, Mike, after watching particularly the Red Series, I can't help but feel there's a serious lack of leadership and discipline on the Mets. When Manaea, who's playing a lot better, was asked about leadership, he proceeded to answer, and then naming every veteran player on the team. I was a bit stunned that his response didn't even include the manager. This lack of pivotal leaders shows on the field to play when the team looks rudderless. Consequently, we see Semien waste the final ABS challenge in the second inning in a low-leverage situation. After the game, Mendoza says he spoke to him, while Semien proceeded to come out the next day and waste another challenge in the second inning. It's clear there's a lack of respect or confidence in Mendy by the players, that they're taking the player-friendly attitude for granted. I'm convinced the lack of accountability, leadership, and discipline is a primary reason for the collapse in play we've seen since June of last year. Sean, I don't disagree. I mean, this is the part that we just don't know about. And I think that, and maybe this is where Stearns is too emotionalist, you're not going to bring a fiery manager in like, you know, a Tommy Lasorda type or a Wally Backman type or someone like that in the middle of the season in a Stearns front office. They just don't believe in that stuff. And the part of the issue is a fiery type A personality manager, even a Davey Johnson type, that, and I'm not talking about obviously about those guys, but I'm talking about personalities like that, is they just don't get along with the front office. The front office would have to consequently say to themselves, I want a manager who I could speak to, give advice to, that will listen, but I'm going to trust at the end of the day that he is going to do exactly whatever he decides to do, which is going to be his choice on the field. He's going to be the right outcome. You're neutering the front office. You don't have a culture in baseball where the front office has taken the reins as the lead man. And I think that's the thing. The front office is the lead person. When you talk about every team, you know, maybe outside of a Craig Counsell or when Cora was with the Red Sox, there's a hand. I mean, how many managers, if I name you a team off the top of your head, do you even know the manager? Arizona, Pittsburgh, Colorado, Walt Weiss, right? Well, Walt Weiss was Atlanta. I'm sorry. Walt Weiss is Atlanta. What am I talking about? Colorado. I got a brain fart there. I mean, like that. I was thinking the Rockies or Walt Weiss at some point. I mean, even, you know, Don Mattingly, of course, because he's Don Mattingly, and it's the Phillies in there in your backyard. You don't. And that's a baseball problem. And I don't know if they value these things. I think they're so emotionalist. And the ABS, these are fair points. Sean's making a very fair point. What's the strategy on the ABS? Is this something that falls into bullpen management? And if Mendoza's lost on it, and he hasn't been able to buy, you know, it's almost July 1st, wrangle this in, like, hey. And Semien is a veteran. I don't disagree with that. I got Jeff Cohen, our friend Jeff Cohen, writing to me about the Spider-Man mask, how embarrassed he was. And this is a guy, he's never been in the Fire Mendoza camp. And he's like, well, you know, what kind of action is he going to take? Like, we've allowed the Overton window here on this whole thing to fly way off to the other side. Like, I'm a manager, I sit with these guys, like, do we really want to do this dugout thing? Like, can we do something that's not totally, I mean, is this Spider-Man mask any team camaraderie? I just hate it. I hate it. And look, I'm an NBA fan, and I hate some of the antics that go on with the trash talk, too, by the way. I hate it. That's all I could say. Tim, Cancel the season, he writes. This will be good. First of all, Tim calls me Dear Mr. Silva. I feel like my dad now, day after Father's Day. I appreciate, Tim, your formal greeting. Thank you. A lot better than some of the greetings I've gotten on X in the last few weeks. At this point, I believe we need to stop trying to salvage the season. It's over, and it's frustrating to see another prime year of Soto's career wasted. Frankly, I don't believe this would have happened under Cashman's leadership, and I feel that David Stearns needs to be held accountable. It's clear why the Brewers don't seem to miss him. Furthermore, the idea of Freddie Peralta seeking a Max Fried-level contract is quite frankly laughable. I do not see the Mets making the playoffs next year under this current management. Additionally, I believe you owe Pete Crow Armstrong an apology. You have been overly critical of him while remaining defensive about the awful trade that sent him away. He currently holds an 870 OPS, plays elite defense in center field, and is third in WAR. Luis Robert is not producing at that level, despite what you suggested. I hope you take these points into consideration. Also, I hear you saying the Mets farm system is good. Hate to break it to you, but it's not. A lot of prospects have taken huge steps back, and McClain, Bench, and Ewing are no longer prospects. It's below average farm. Being a Mets fan gets harder and harder. So, Tim, great points by Tim. Great points. So, thank you. Thank you for the formal email. In an era of disrespect, I mean, I'm not making fun of Tim. I mean, it's nice. But you can call me Mike. I'll let you call me Mike next time. Are they wasting a prime year of Soto's career? Yes. Do I see this front office as being hopeless? No. Do I think this would have happened under Cashman? The Yankees and the I really believe, and again, I'm going to go bringing up, you know, the Knicks again. And this is a going forward the Knicks. When you build with a player, in the case of the Knicks, Brunson, or in the case of the Yankees over the, you know, from the core four to Judge and some of the players that have, you know, you have this aura. And I know that that's not analytical, but the Yankees have always been able to leverage since 1996 and build upon history, aura, and that season. Now, can the Knicks do it with what just happened? NBA is different with a salary cap league, and maybe baseball will go there. But in baseball, where you just could continue to spend and spend and build, they've been able to do that. I talked about the weight of the uniform, something that Josh Hart talked about during his post-game press conference after they beat the Spurs. And I believe that all New York teams, particularly the Mets and Yankees, along with the Knicks, I don't know about the hockey teams and the NFL teams as much, but I think that the Mets have right now one of the heaviest uniforms. And I think that the Knicks have, it's still going to be expectations and heavy, but I think it's been lightened up a little bit. And I think the Mets have some of the heaviest ones because of the love that the fan base has, the paranoia that's developed within the fan base, the horrible disappointments that the fan base has had, particularly in the last 20 years. 20 to 25 years. So I think that plays into all this. I don't want to make any statements about next year now. I think there's a lot of work to do with this roster. And I don't disagree that now that Benge and McClain and Ewing have been promoted, the farm system, and Ernie Dove, we'll get him on again. It's taken a step back, and there's a lot of injuries and a lot of underperformance there. I've talked about it. But the fact that you have three guys on the roster who are high impact in McClain, the rotation, and Benge and Ewing, and let's face it, Benge, another home run last night. He's around 720 OPS. Let me bring him up real quick and see what he's been doing in the last couple of months, because he had a horrible, horrible, horrible April. So, not that you throw it out, but that could have been the adjustment. That could have been the adjustment that maybe he should have had in AAA. But he's had an OPS. He had over 300 in May with an 801 OPS. He's hitting 270 in June with an 843 OPS. Maybe the walks need to improve, but you know he's doing his job. He's doing his job, and Ewing seems very promising. Now to Pete Crow Armstrong. Would Pete Crow Armstrong look great in center field, along with Benge and Ewing in the corners? Well, maybe they wouldn't be here. Maybe they would have traded if they had Prankhorn. Maybe one of them would have been traded. Who knows? With Soto as the DH, yes, he would. Now, here's the thing about Pete Carl Armstrong. Here's why I've been critical. In the past, he's been streaky, like he was last year, and he hasn't hit left-handed pitching, and he hasn't walked enough, and he struck out way too much. Here's why you should be a little more bullish, but be careful. He's been okay up until June. He's having a monster June with like a 1,500 OPS, right? But he's hitting left-handed pitching. That's huge. And so far, year to date, he's walked 28 times after walking only 29 times last year. If you look at June and you just start to look at the walks, I just want to bring up the walks because I think that is an indicator of plate discipline. I mean, he's got an OPS of 800 against lefties. That's huge. In May, when he had a 762 OPS, he actually walked 13 times. So although he wasn't hitting, he was starting to get on base a little bit. Now, I don't watch him every day, and I have to dive deeper into the metrics, but you're right. And here's the other question, Tim. Would the Mets fans, even if he had not been traded for Javier Baez and they tried to salvage the 2021 season, and Zach Scott has talked about this over and over and over again, so, you know, I don't think it's necessary to rehash why they traded. And I haven't been defensive over it. I just put context into, at the time, Cohen's first season of ownership. We didn't know DeGrom would be out the rest of the season, but we knew DeGrom was headed towards the end of maybe his time in New York. He was having that career year that if you made a short tournament playoff with him and Stroman, I didn't see why the Mets couldn't win a couple of rounds. I mean, the Braves won the World Series. They were bad most of the year. Look, there's another example of a team underachieving most of the year and making a run late in a division, not a wild card muck that didn't the Mets didn't seize. So I understood it at the time. It's not ideal. And since then, if you look at David Stearns, for all the criticism, when he traded for Freddie Peralta in the offseason, mind you, and even when he made those deadline deals last year, I don't think there's really anybody that's going to come back to haunt you in those deals. He knew what the right players to trade and who to hold back. I mean, I guess we'll see, right? But, you know, different time. Now, would the Mets fans with Armstrong's penchant for strikeout, streakiness, lack of hitting lefty over the first couple of years, would they have been as patient here in New York with him? Would the weight of the uniform that I just talked about suck him up? You know, maybe. You know, you don't know. So, I mean, that's something also to do this. Going back to our friend Jeff Cohen, he talks about, and Jeff sent me a couple of different emails, so I'll go to Jeff again. Mike, the inconsistency of this team is maddening. Play well versus the Yankees, Padres, and Braves, yet can't get out of their own way versus Cincinnati, Miami, and the Rockies. I think the Reds are a little bit better than the Rockies, and the Marlins aren't that bad, Jeff. As you say, they're in the muck, yet if not for the 12-game losing streak, they'd be in the middle of the muck. As of this email, the team is 6.5 games out of the last wild card. Is that insurmountable? No, as we aren't at the All-Star break yet, but it's getting late early. With all the injuries to this team, the biggest blow seems to have been Clay Holmes. I think he's missed more than Lindor. The pitching is such disarray with bullpen games twice a week. The kids are doing well, but I like to see Benj lead off games with a bunt now and then to let Bichette and Soto try to drive him in. This would also open up the infield as the defense would have to defend against the bunt. All wannabe GMs and social media want to trade Vientos. He's one of the worst offensive players in the league, according to the WAR. And I know all the other 29 teams know that, why would anyone trade for him? All you would get, as they would say, is a bag of balls. I don't even know if you get a bag of balls now, Jeff. And can we get rid of this stupid Spider-Man mask after the home run? It's embarrassing. Jeff, I mean, I basically, he texted me because I gave Jeff my phone number. You know, he has a great show, Baseball and Barbecue. And we've had lunch. And if you aren't listening to Baseball and Barbecue, you should. He's got some great guests. Not a Mets show. Great guests. But look, he's right on a lot of things. I think the Clay Holmes injury was a big blow. He was having a great season. I think that sounds like he's on track to be back. And I didn't think we'd see him again this year, or maybe not till September. He's on track to be back. And, you know, we'll have to see where that goes. But I can't disagree with anything he said. In theory, McClain, Peralta, and Holmes should be a good threesome at the top of the rotation. I know Peterson and Senga have been very disappointing. They're bringing shades of 2025 back. And, you know, that's just, you know, at this point, I don't have any hope on any of those guys being anywhere near consistent there. Peterson's not going to be a Met after this year. And, you know, Senga, I don't know what you're going to do there. I just don't know what you're going to do there. But, look, I wrote about this in the premium content. The difference between the Mets and the Phillies with the run differential is that the Phillies have these two elite starting pitchers at the top of the rotation, whereas the Mets have inconsistency up and down the rotation. And the bullpen, the shame of it is you're wasting a great bullpen season. I think the offense has struggled, but with Lindor about a week away, it looks like, I think it's going to get better. You should be able to, with a healthy Holmes, McClain, Peralta, Christian Scott, let's say he's back, that's not a bad rotation. And then you could play around maybe with that fifth spot. That's where maybe if you were closer to the wild card, going out and getting yourself a veteran. I keep bringing up Michael Wacha because I think he would fit well without the cost of going after the top of the market. You probably would have something there. I think you would. So it'll be interesting. You know, I know that some people are talking about what happened to Tobias Myers. I still think Tobias Myers is a reliever. I think that he's a guy that after 30, 40, 50 pitches, there's a lot of contact in his game too. So maybe this recent stretch is more regression. I still think he's a good pitcher. I think they have to think about what he really is. If he's a starter and he's going to be a mediocre back end of the rotation, starter league average, slightly below league average, then just make him that. Don't just keep jerking him back and forth. I don't think that's healthy for him either. So, you know, that was something for me to bring up. But that's it. That's all I have for you today. I got to wrap it up here. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. Of course, keep joining me over at the premium content over at the Substack. Go to TalkingMetsPodcast.com. We're going to dive deeper into some of these things that we talked about. We're not quitting. We're not giving up. We're not taking off. We're the Knicks celebration. You know, our champagne for those who are Knicks fans that are part of the community here. We got to wipe that champagne out of our eyes, that confetti out of our hair, and start focusing back on the baseball team. I know it's tough, but you know, this is another passion of ours. And let's see where this goes. And at the very least, I think it'll be a fascinating trade deadline because how the Mets approach it is going to determine a lot of how relevant 2027 is going to be. And to the point made by Tim over here on the mailbag, he didn't have a lot of faith that 27, oh, this management team could build a good team. I think Steve Cohen's going to give Stearns his full contract to prove all of us that's not the case. All right. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to this latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all that. TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks on the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.